Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. Roger McNamee, co-founder of Elevation Partners, also one of the leaders of the band Moon Alice, and he joins us here in our 1130 studios based in Menlo Park, California. Roger, a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Pim, it is always fun to be on Bloomberg Radio.
All right. Are you addicted to the internet?
Well, I'm definitely addicted to social media and my smartphone. In fact, the realization of that fact was one of those incredibly disappointing things where I went, oh my gosh. You know, I think of myself as self-disciplined. I think of myself as being fitness-oriented, and the realization that this thing was controlling my life was not my finest hour.
When was this? And I should also note that you got an iPad in your hands right now.
I do, and in fact, so I have spent 35 years as an investor in the technology industry, and I've always been an early adopter. And I've always felt that technology was a thing that it was a tool, but it was a tool that could make my life better in a lot of ways. And that has been consistently true. I mean, notwithstanding all of the aggravation, if you think 35 years, you're going back, whoa, 1982, that's the very beginning of personal computers. And God knows a lot of the products along the way have delivered less than their initial promise. The challenge that we have with internet platforms on smartphones is that for the first time, we have a device in a smartphone that can really deliver any kind of content, more or less anywhere. Solution. Every moment that you're awake. And, you know, like everyone else, I did not anticipate how that was going to change my life. I mean, the good parts were obvious immediately. The dark side became clear only, shall we say, with a lag. And sadly, that lag was well past the point at which I was largely unable to modify my behavior.
So, Roger, you're an early investor with both Google and Facebook, and you've been writing columns basically bashing them for the past year or so, basically saying that Facebook and Google threaten public health and democracy. I invested early in Google and Facebook. Now they terrify me. Have you heard any response from either of the companies?
I have not. And so the important thing to understand is that before I went public on this, I spent 4 months appealing to Facebook directly, starting with Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, and then working with other executives that they had delegated to deal with this, beginning in October of 2016, before the election, and accelerating dramatically on November 9th, where I tried for 4 months as a friend of the firm to persuade them that I thought that the things that we were seeing with respect to Brexit, with respect to the U.S. election, with respect to financial firms using Facebook tools to discriminate in housing, some of the things related to Black Lives Matter, some of the things that were going on overseas, that I thought all of those things had a common root, which was to say that the business model of Facebook, the advertising business model, and the way the algorithms were set up created incentives for bad actors to use the platform. And that really terrified me.
You know, I just have to say, we did get Jaina Partners and CalSTRS, the second biggest public pension in the U.S., coming out, putting a letter out, appealing as investors in Apple, appealing that they study the effect of iPhones on children. Apple responds, we're fine, we're good. We have the protections that we need and we're looking at it. I mean, since this behavior has gotten so rooted, is there any financial reason for Facebook, Google, or Apple to modify anything about their businesses?
So that is, I think, a great question. Now, I want to come a little bit to Apple's defense. Apple, as the maker of the iPhone, has an unusual amount of market power here. And to their credit, they've exercised that very constructively over the last year without any external stimuli. The most important thing they did was they've upgraded the operating systems over the last few months, and they eliminated autoplay in internet applications. This is really important for video on the internet. And they essentially made it impossible for Facebook and Netflix to have autoplay be the default thing. And that was a very consumer-friendly thing. They've also been very good at enabling things like ad blockers and tracking blockers to protect your privacy. There's a lot more Apple can do, and I welcome shareholders taking a role here. I do think shareholder activism is going to matter a lot, because I'm very concerned that there is no appetite for regulation of this in the United States. And realistically, we're so early in the process of educating consumers about what's going on that it's going to take years. And, you know, we have an election coming up in November. There will for sure be massive attempts to manipulate, just as there were in 2016, probably coming from people both inside the U.S. and outside, left, right, center, all over the place. I mean, essentially, the Russians showed you that you can use those tools to produce the outcome of your dreams. And we're going to see a lot of people try. Many of them will fail, but we're going to see a lot of people try, because it is inherent in the design of Facebook that the way they talk about bringing people together, but in fact, what the product does is it polarizes. It basically tries to, in order to service its business model — the business model is based on advertising. Advertising is based on engagement. Engagement is based on emotion. The emotions that cause the highest engagement are the ones we call the lizard brain emotions, things like fear and anger. And the problem with fear and anger, obviously, is that they're asymmetric. And people who want to do harm can use fear and anger a lot more effectively than people who want to do good. And I first observed that during Brexit. So when the UK was voting whether to leave the European Union, there was the campaign to leave was based on two kind of outrageous emotional appeals. One, they were going to take all the savings and bail out the National Health Service. And the one they really focused on was terrifying people about the role that immigrants were playing in the economy and in the culture. And the Remain campaign, the other side, had a very sedate kind of, you know, stay the course, unemotional appeal. They were doomed. And we don't know exactly, but we suspect that the economic advantage to the Leave campaign of using products like Facebook was roughly 20-1. That is, if you had a negative, you know, tear it down kind of thing, a thing that appealed to anger and fear, you get roughly 20 times the reach for every dollar you invest. And that is a prohibitive advantage, and it's asymmetric. There is nothing that the people with the positive campaign can do, because Facebook isn't structured to emphasize the positive. It's structured to emphasize the negative. That's a choice.
Real quick, 20 seconds. Do you still own any stake in Google and Facebook?
I do own a stake in Facebook because I'm trying to help them get this right. I want to work with them.
But would you sell it if they didn't do it right?
Eventually, yes, of course. But I hold hope. I mean, I think these are smart people. I think they're good people. I don't think they intended to do this.
Roger McNamee, thank you so much for joining us. Always, always a pleasure speaking with you. Roger McNamee is co-founder of Elevation Partners in Menlo Park, California. He's also in a band, Moon Alice. He's got the calluses on his fingers to show it. We were going to ask him to freestyle, and he was prepared. So maybe the rest of the show will be just that. Thank you so much for joining us. Tesla, the company that continues to defy calls for its demise. Tesla is burning through about $1 billion of cash each quarter, and now it's having trouble meeting its goals with respect to production, meaning it's probably going to have to raise more money. Here with us to talk about its debt profile and how it might meet its financing needs is Joel Levington, senior credit analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, who joins us in our 1130 studios. Joel, Tesla has already issued debt. It has fallen in price with yields rising since issuance. What are its options at this point? for raising money in the debt market?
Sure. Well, I think they have a few options. They've issued both senior unsecured notes. They could always go back to that market. To me, I think they would be smarter to use a convertible instrument. They have several convertible bonds that are outstanding, mainly because at this point in time, when cash flow is weak, to put on a fixed layer of interest expense on top of that really puts extra pressure on the P&L and also on the balance sheet.
Joel, does this also include the debt that was incurred by the purchase of SolarCity?
That's exactly right. And one of the interesting things about how the rating agencies look at Tesla is that none of that SolarCity debt is guaranteed. So essentially, Tesla could walk away from it if they chose to, but the rating agencies include it in all their calculations as if they would never walk away from it. I find that to be interesting simply because the SolarCity bonds, like you get a 2019 SolarCity bond at about 5.5%, not all that different than the 7-year bond, the Tesla bond that is in the index. So clearly there's some liquidity there, but you're also cutting down your term risk by about 7 years.
So I'm looking right now at Tesla bonds, the ones that are due in August of 2025, currently yielding about 6%, priced under 96 cents on the dollar. And I have to wonder, this is well below other companies in the high yield bond market as far as the price goes, higher yield. Are bond investors going to buy this? I mean, honestly, Tesla has not proven that they can be profitable or come through on its promises.
Right. Investors will buy it because they did buy it.
They did buy it and they've been punished for it.
And they have been punished for it. I think the thing is that, the company is very polarizing. People either feel very strongly that it's going to change the world and, that would be great if it does. And other people feel like it's miserable and will never achieve its goals. And a senior unsecured piece of paper doesn't really work for either of those cases. If you are feeling strong about the company, that's a place where you're saying I should be bullish and not like look to clip a 5.3% coupon. I should be in the equity. If you feel very against the company, then you wouldn't be in the bonds or the equity.
Right. So basically, you're getting none of the upside with the bond and all of the downside risk with the senior unsecured bond. Whereas convertible, you kind of are mixing the two. You're giving them financing. You're not diluting shareholders, but you're also getting some stake in the potential upside. So you're saying that it's likely or it would be appropriate for Tesla to look at convertible bonds for financing. Does this mean that the unsecured bond market is, I don't want to say closed to them, but only available to them if they're willing to pay up a lot more than they did last time around?
Right. Well, as you can see now that their bonds are, somewhere about 5.75% to 6%. So they could issue new bonds. I don't think that would be a problem issuing more unsecured bonds if they wanted to. I just think strategically it doesn't make a lot of sense to go that route, especially when your equity price is so high. Now is the time to, worry about getting your business operations together as opposed to layering in additional financial risk through an unsecured issue.
I understand that they've got, about $418 million that in bond principal that is due this year?
That's right. And at least based on my math, it looks like they'll be free cash flow negative by about $1.8 billion. So, if they went back to the market for somewhere between $2 and $2.5 billion this year, I wouldn't be unsurprised.
Wait, just back up. So in other words, they're going to be negative. They're going to earn negative $1.8 billion this year.
In other words, their capital expenditure should be somewhere in the $3.2 billion, or their cash flow should be about $1.4 billion. So that would give you about negative $1.8 billion, which is not that surprising for a company that's in a rapid growth mode. But companies in rapid growth modes really shouldn't be playing with unsecured debt, and in either case, whether you go to a senior secured piece of paper that will prime your bond that's outstanding, that's in the Bloomberg Barclays index, or alternatively, if you're doing more converts, that would be kind of along the lines where you're getting a lower coupon issue.
If Tesla were to issue a $2.2 billion convertible bond offering, that would be a massive, massive convertible issuance. Do you anticipate that they could do the whole thing in the convertible bond?
They might. And, I would say this is something that's interesting. If you look back at past issuances, the stock has actually gone up when they've issued convertible debt. The stock has actually gone up because there's the liquidity fear that's in there. that's baked into Tesla, right? It's a very hit or miss. You're either going to have a moonshot and it's going to be unbelievably awesome, or you have a heavy financial risk. So the stock market has actually approved of them issuing converts.
Well, I mean, liquidity risk, saying basically they're burning through cash. They're not going to be able to keep in business if they can't raise money. So if they can raise money without diluting shareholders and without incurring huge interest payments, that's a good thing.
That's true.
Well, there you go. I don't know where to go with this, except that they're going to have to raise some money pretty quickly.
I would think so. You know, if
what's the clock on this $418 million repayment?
Well, the $418 million shouldn't be that troubling to them. They did have $3.5 billion of cash on the on the balance sheet at September 30th. It's really more of, you know, like if I'm thinking more strategically out for a couple of years, how do I need to finance this company until it moves going from a cash user, a high growth company, cash burner, into more of a cash cow?
They got to get that Model 3 out there in the public. Thanks very much for joining us. Joel Levington is our senior credit analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, telling us all about Tesla. We consult Ira Jersey, our interest rate strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, for details about the economy and interest rates. Ira, I want you to begin, if you can, all the way at the back end of your latest report, because I found it very interesting about household growth in the United States. I wonder if you could enlighten us a little bit about what has happened to household growth and who's actually living at home.
Yeah, so household growth has been very slow since the global financial crisis almost a decade ago now, and one of the big reasons for that. So we always focus on retirees, and we know that there's an aging population in general, but that's not necessarily what's holding household growth back. What's holding household growth back is young workers. So these are people 25 to 34 who are living at home in the greatest numbers ever, and also as a percentage of that age group, it's now 16% of that age group living at home, when it used to be historically between 8 and 11%. So you're talking about 50% more young workers living at home. And that has major impacts on the economy, because these folks aren't buying houses, they're not renting apartments, they're not buying refrigerators, they're not getting household services. They're basically using the household services for their parents, at their parents' house. So that is a constraint on growth right now. And you know, that's kind of this fiscal situation, that's the kind of thing monetary policy can't fix.
So, Ira, can you bring that sort of reality into the market right now, and what we're seeing with 10-year yields trying to break out of this 2.62% threshold that a lot of people say is sort of the tipping point? How does this relate?
Well, it's not necessarily relating to, you know, the move that we are seeing today, or some of the or some of the kind of day-to-day moves, but I think it shows that one of the reasons why inflation has been and continues to be a bit lower than people would like it to be. It's just that there's a various socioeconomic and demographic factors that are driving inflation to be somewhat lower. Now, that being said, when you look at things like what's gone on with oil prices recently and how high they're going, that's helping increase inflation expectations, at least at the headline level, even if core inflation isn't necessarily going up. So you look at what's happened just in the last couple of weeks, and you've seen a good, you know, 10 basis point move in things like 5-year inflation break even. So the market's expectation of what inflation is going to average over the next 5 years, and that's coincided quite closely with the uptick in oil prices. So I think that's one of the several drivers of yields in the near term.
So the idea that there are all of these younger people living at home, is there any evidence out there that anything would push them out of their parents' basements and into their own homes? Or is this just going to be a new reality?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for the time being, it has to be it's probably a new reality. I think part of it ends up being what happens when you do get more retirees actually retiring and creating new jobs. I think wage pressures and wage growth has to pick up. I think once you see a significant amount of wage growth, you can wind up seeing some of these people move out of their parents' homes. I think a big part of it is that age group now, as a share of income compared compared to people 20 years older than them, their wages are lower than they have been, historically speaking. So I think that has to catch up. So it's kind of this distribution of wages, if you will, that winds up mattering somewhat. I think for the market today, though, you know, we're looking at things like monetary policy overseas. So things like the Bank of Japan hinting that they might scale back their purchases. The ECB, we know, is already starting to buy less bonds out there. And that's a non-trivial reason why we're seeing some of today's market action with, you know, 30-year yields back up 6 basis points, which is a relatively substantial move these days.
So, Ira, if a client were to call and say, why is there this big sell-off at the long end? Why are we down 1 8/32nds? What's up with that 2.87% yield on the 30-year? What's your answer?
Yeah, that's all about the Bank of Japan action, firstly, and then secondly, just you know, we saw the most recent tick up, so in the last 2 basis points in yield moves higher after we got the JOLTS job opening report at just a couple of minutes ago, and that showed that labor market tightness seems to still be the case. So you have, you know, between monetary policy actions, so basically less bond buying globally by central banks, and then on top of that, an economy that at worst is in a steady state of modest improvement, all of those things should lead to somewhat better inflation and growth outcomes, and that should mean somewhat higher yields. I think one of the things that's not likely to persist is the curve steepening, because I do think that eventually the Federal Reserve, if this continues and we start to get higher inflation, the Federal Reserve will actually meet the dot plot, which the market isn't yet pricing, and because of that, you wind up with today's steepening probably being unwound and actually additional flattening to occur later in the year.
In other words, we're going to get faster rate hikes in response.
Yeah, well, faster rate hikes than the market's currently pricing. The market's still only pricing about 2 rate hikes, and the Fed still thinks that they're going to go 3. So if the Fed were to go 3, that would mean that the market would have to catch up to the Fed.
Ira Jersey, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Ira Jersey is Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. That Congress has passed a tax bill, are they going to move on to infrastructure and what is needed with respect to the infrastructure of the United States? Here to talk about that with us is Susan Story, President and Chief Executive Officer of American Waterworks Company, which is based in Voorhees, New Jersey. It is the largest publicly traded water utility in the country. Susan, thank you so much for joining us. I just want to start with asking you about the tax plan. I know that you had noted that the extra money that you get, you will put back into your infrastructure. Do you view this as possibly being a little bit of an infrastructure plan in the fact that you get more money?
Well, thank you, Lisa, first of all, for the invitation to participate. And absolutely, the interesting thing for regulated utilities is that this Tax Cuts and Job Act actually is an infrastructure plan. And let me explain that just quickly. In the regulatory environment, whenever we pay taxes, if it's prudently incurred, we get a pass-through to customers dollar for dollar. So the less taxes we pay, the more money then that goes back to our customers, the less they have to pay. So for every dollar of O&M we save, like taxes or interest, we get to put $8 of infrastructure in the ground at no impact on the customer bills. So when you have decades needs of capital and you have a situation where you can take those O&M dollars and translate those into capital investment, it's good for everybody.
Susan Story, I wonder if you could just give us an update on any of the active rate cases that you are currently involved in. I know that at least you were focused on Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Missouri. Maybe just give us an update if you can.
Yeah, sure. So Pennsylvania was resolved at the end of 2017. We are currently in rate cases in New Jersey and Missouri and looking to hopefully have those resolved this year.
And will that affect, or is that part of your 5-year strategic plan? I understand that you're going to be spending about $8 billion.
So our capital plan is based on the needs of the business. And in many of our states, we have what's called future test years where they look at the capital plans up front. But as long as we can show that we need to make this investment, which we do, you know, in this country, 44% of water pipe is near the end of life. Now, our replacement rate is about twice as good as the national average, but even we are at a replacement of equal to every 120 years. So when it comes to pipes, plants, pumps, and cyber, there's a tremendous need for capital investment, and this tax act is going to allow us to do more of that while keeping the customer bills low.
Susan, what would you say to people who say that the tax plan as drafted, and the fact that it will likely add trillions of dollars to the deficit, or more than $1 trillion, I should say, to the deficit over the next 10 years, that actually reduces the chance that Congress is going to pass or really make progress on a real, true infrastructure bill. Are you concerned about that? Do you feel like this is maybe one step forward, two steps back?
You know, that's a great question, Lisa. And I think that, you know, I've mentioned for regulated utilities that they're one and the same. I do think for the country that we need an infrastructure package that fully leverages private investment and also partners with public entities. And one of the things, PricewaterhouseCoopers looked at just the water utility industry, and what they found is if you look at public water, which is 84% of all water, for example, that that we could, by doing some simple steps, unleash $43 to $63 billion in private money, and that if under wastewater, $15 to $25. And these are things like when a municipality decides to sell a system, if they have any tax bonds that were tax exempt, they have to pay those off before they can sell their system. They can't even keep those. So there's certain things that we think an infrastructure bill can contain that will further leverage private money and not require that the federal government fund the entire cost.
But Susan, are you concerned that the prospects for that kind of bill are getting dimmer given the passage of the tax legislation?
I think it's going to be interesting, given your comment about the projections for the deficit and how that will play out. I do know, however, that both sides of the aisle understand that we have an infrastructure problem in this country. I think what the solutions look like will be impacted by that, but I hope for the sake of the country that we can come together and do something to incentivize the construction of more roads and bridges and the replacement of water and wastewater and other infrastructure that we so desperately need for the economy.
One of the big wins, I think, for your company was the Wright-Patterson base, Air Force base, to take over their water, wastewater and water facilities. How long does it usually take after a contract win for any changes in rates or predetermination of rates to take place?
Tim, that's a great question. So with Wright-Patterson, we are projected to take over operations in July of this year. So typically, after 2 years, as you just said, there's price redeterminations that if there are changes in laws, that if, for example, if there's an environmental law that requires more costs, we can increase the amount of O&M. The tax changes will eventually, over the life of these price redeterminations, bring those costs down, but that will allow us to do more capital upgrades on the military bases that we serve, all 13 of them across the country.
And just further, if you could speak about some of the natural disasters that the country has been hit by in the last 12 months. You've been affected not only in California, but in Louisiana and other areas of the country. Give us an update if you can.
That's exactly right. We are spread across the entire country. So typically when there's a natural disaster, it affects either our regulated business or our market-based business. Our focus is on building resilient systems that can withstand hurricanes, ice storms, flooding, the fires in California, for example. So part of that infrastructure investment is on resiliency of critical assets. We've identified 50 critical assets that serve 80% of our customers across the country, and we have a plan to ensure that we build resiliency. For example, a flood wall in a water plant in New Jersey that serves 1 million people. We've just finished a $65 million project that will protect it against a 500-year flood because we had 3 100-year floods in the period of 7 years. So the issue of resiliency of our system is a critical critical one, and again, a reason that we have to get serious about infrastructure investment in this country.
Just real quick, Susan, when analysts come on or investors who invest in the stock market come on our show, they always talk about utilities as being a bond proxy, and utilities are falling now in the stock market as a response to falling bond prices, rising yields. Does that frustrate you?
We know it's interesting, and we did file an 8K in December that said because we had offered guidance on December 11th that we need to re-look at everything that the Tax Act will do to make sure that we, you know, can, at our year-end call, affirm, not affirm, or make any changes we need to. But with that said, in the past, you know, we've enjoyed an EPS growth of 7 to 10%, and we have had a dividend yield and a dividend increase that's been above 10%. Over a CAGR over the past 5 years. So when you talk about a bond proxy, you're talking about a return that equivocates a bond. And for, at least for American Water, we don't fit that profile.
Thank you very much for being with us. Susan Story is the chief executive of American Water.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.